Jumping in on Manx Radio
with Howard and Chris Kane.
Hello.
Good evening.
And welcome. And here we are once again on a Saturday night on Manx Radio, 9 o'clock. It is Jumping In, the best in modern and contemporary jazz, and we are heading north of the border for something of a special.
Yes, no less the great Tommy Smith, a man who has been responsible for the life of jazz in Scotland for many years now. And you could say he's been rolling along like a juggernaut.
No answer to that. Thank you.
tell us about young Tommy, maybe, as opposed to Tommy OBE. I mean, obviously Scotland's a very important part of your life and your music as well. But when you got the opportunity, what actually did you feel about going away to Berkeley? It must have been a huge jump for you at the time.
I was just talking about this the other day, in fact, because I found the program when I was 16, playing this gig at Berkeley. I found the actual program from that gig, and that particular event changed my future life. But I remember, you know, like most kids, you're just passionate about music, and that's all you care about. You don't care about anything else. Play, 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 and it's always live, and it's always for you don't really care about the money or anything like that. So when I came from Scotland to Berkeley, I was 16, and I'd only known live music played in bars and for the BBC, and I'd cut a few records. I had lots of really great opportunities. People had approached me and said, you know, we want you to record an album for our label, or, you know, and of course I was naive and taken advantage of, but I did it and got in the press and had, you know, lots of doors open, but didn't have any money. Couldn't go to Berkeley immediately because my parents are very poor, were from an impoverished background. I didn't even have a saxophone until we got a grant from the Prince's Trust. And I was playing the school saxophone, which was falling, was literally falling to pieces because I practiced it quite a lot. And so I'd have to go to the metal department and they'd have to solder the bits back on, even though they didn't know anything about, you know, how to fix an instrument. But, you know, I was really grateful to my community in Wester Hills where I grew up, and for Edinburgh, who raised lots of money for me to go for that first year. And so when I left, of course, I was feeling quite a lot of pressure, because I felt indebted to them because they had believed in something like me, and being from a poor background, this is a huge amount of money. You know, even a small amount of money was a lot of money. You know, because we didn't have any. You only know this in retrospect, because if you grow up impoverished, you don't know that. You're happy because that's all you know.
That's what you got. Yeah,
you got on with it. But it's only in retrospect people say, hey, you were impoverished, and you go, oh, all right, but I was happy. So you didn't feel you were impoverished of happiness, but you were impoverished because of money. But it still didn't matter. We had you know, lots of support and kind people around us. But when I went to Berkeley, then I suddenly felt the pressure was really on me. So, you know, I was a really one of these weird students, I think, because talking to other people since then, they're going, you're weird, you know, because I didn't drink, I didn't party, I didn't have a girlfriend, didn't go, all I did was music and go to my classes. I never missed a class. I practiced after the classes until 3-4 in the morning. And that's all I did every day. I did nothing else.
Thank you.
it was just that concert in 85 with Chick Corea that changed my whole direction, because everybody at Berklee joined a big band. And that's what I thought my future was, joining Buddy Rich big band or Woody Herman, or because everybody around me was getting headhunted to go in those bands. Yeah. And so I thought, I don't really enjoy playing in a big band whatsoever. Even though when I was at Berklee, I was in 10 different bands, part of the school curriculum, the Buddy Rich big band, the Duke Ellington big band, the Count Basie big band. I was playing in the section and I never enjoyed it because I'm dyslexic. And because I was dyslexic, I found it really hard to read music. And for me to read music, I have to practice like four times harder than somebody beside me, because I have to actually learn it. So when I sit and look like I'm reading, I'm actually not really reading. I've played it so much that I know it better than the person who's reading it, in a way. I've always found it really difficult because I couldn't see, you know, the strobing and all this. Oh, I just had to learn it as much as I could. So I never fancied playing in the big band. Plus, I was a quartet player. And all of a sudden, I got asked to play in the quartet with Chick Corea amongst, you know, there's 2,000 students, and I was 17, I think. And so that was a big challenge. And I loved that record from 84, his three quartets. It was one of my favorite records. And I was getting to play some of those tunes. So it was like my favorite music and Chick Corea. And plus, I was nervous as hell and shaking like a leaf with butterflies and everything. And the concert's in front of 2,000 students. So you're scared out your wits. So there's other obstacles there. But that's when Gary Burton, who was he was producing the event, because it was the very first time an artist in residence came to Berklee. And it was set up in 85, and Chick Corea was the very first artist to spend a whole week at the school presenting masterclasses. And so Chick recommended me to Gary Burton on that particular gig. I don't know why he didn't want me in his band, but I must have had an issue. Obviously, you know, he didn't like me, but he recommended me to Gary Burton. So I got this gig from Gary Burton, and my whole career shifted. Money actually ran out after a year, It was £6,500 roughly, and it was managed by my high school, WEC, and the music department there. And it ran out because the tuition and the flights and the accommodation, and I had a partial scholarship, but so they all ran out. So after a year, I had to go home, or I had to convince the school to let me stay on. So I basically started, I know I had to leave after a year. And so I went to my teachers, George Garzone and various other teachers that I knew, and I asked them to petition for me to get a full scholarship. But not only that, that I could get accommodation in the dormitory and food. And Berkeley gave me the full whack. So after that year, they gave me full scholarship and accommodation and my meals every day. So that's all I needed. And then Gary Burton said, you can be in my band or go to school. And I was like, excuse me? He said, well, you can't be in both. You've got to either join my band or go to school. And this is ironic because he's the dean. No, he was the vice president by then. He was a dean of curriculum, and then he became vice president. So he's vice president at Berkeley, saying to me, you can be in my band or go to school, but you can't be in both. So I chose to go in his band. And that was when my other education began, which was, you know, improvisation, touring, seeing what other countries had in relation to their infrastructures in music and education and jazz orchestras. And I came to the realization after touring all over the planet that Scotland was in the Stone Age. Yeah.
Thank you. So is that what brought you back in so many ways after having had, going into rapid success, really going from, playing around Scotland over to Berkeley, then straight out with Gary and touring the world. So was it that which sort of drove you to come back to Scotland again? You're wanting to get back to your roots and really bring them up so they were on a standard with the rest of the world.
It wasn't that quick, but the events that took place was I spent my time in Gary's band. Mm-hmm. And while I was in his band, I got a Blue Note deal, which he helped engineer and contract. And at that point, Gary's like, well, you've got your contract, you got to go on your own, you've got to do this stuff. And, basically getting fired, but in a very nice way. And I'm very good friends with Gary. We speak all the time, all on the internet. And so, but I did get fired in the most beautiful way to take my career to the next level. So then I started my Blue Note period. Mm-hmm. And, got my manager and agent in England. That was 4 years. And I moved to Paris, studied composition in that period. That's why I wrote that record, Paris.
Paris, yeah.
Blue Note.
Yeah. And then I came back to Scotland in 93. So I'd left in 83 and I came back in 93, even though I was back and forth a lot because I had this band, cooperative band with Forward Motion. And we had recorded two albums, one live from Berkeley Performance Center. Sorry, it just brings back really funny memories. Oh, it's hilarious thinking about that. We recorded this one of our recitals. All the students get to play their big concert at the end of their year. And, you market it, you make posters, you put them on lampposts, you really do a good promotion job, and you get your fellow students into the room But we were playing in the concert hall, which is that 2,000 seat concert hall, and it's being recorded and all that. So we basically, what we did is we went into the library and we borrowed the tapes, the analog reels. I'm not quite sure who did it, but there was two of us who were involved in that maneuver. So we took the analog and we went to a studio and mastered it.
And then that's the Berkeley tapes.
Yeah, then we sold it to a record company for £1,000, Hep Records. And we said to them, on no account mention Berkeley on this, because what we did was illegal. And we'll get into a lot of trouble. And we were just kids. You know, I was 17. This is in 84, I think. And so the record comes out, and it's huge, big lettering on the front. The Berkeley tapes. We're like, oh my God. So the distribution of this record, you know, it's even distributed in Cambridge, Massachusetts, across the road from Berkeley. And we were like, oh my God. And so Berkeley, because it's got Berkeley on the cover, and I find this out later when I joined Gary Burton's band, he said, yeah, we had a big board meeting about that recording. The whole Senate around this board, we had the album, we were talking about all these guys, how we would punish you. And then we listened to the record and we thought, this is so good, we're going to let it run because this is great promotion for the school, and we're not going to penalize any of these students for doing this, because a lot of the people on the board were musicians as well and whatever. So they could have expelled us, come down hard on us, but they did the opposite. They did what you would think an institution wouldn't do, and what they did is embrace it and love it. So that was amazing to hear, huh?
Well, now we know why he sacked you from the band. Just a bit of risk management band. The Isle of Man is a very small place, and we seem to get people that go off all around the world, but they always come back, you know. And I think maybe that's something about the heart of the place, which is important in your composition and in your music and in your love of all of that. I don't know. Do you feel that sort of really has been part of what's driven you forward with that? Is relating to the history of Scotland as well?
I think it's looking at other examples from other countries for me. Like, so if I look at Denmark, for example, and I look at Niels Henning Oster-Pedersen, and I look at his influence on the level of bass players that have come from that country, it's due to the fact that he stayed in that country and he didn't move somewhere else. If I look at Norway and I look at Garbarek, who stayed in Norway, and I look at the number of saxophone players who've risen from his inspiration, it's only because he stayed there and inspired them and did what he did. So I think for me, it was important to stay here to help the future generation, whoever they may be. And that was one element. I mean, Norway's like late years ahead of Scotland in many regards, regarding music education, either their jazz infrastructure, their jazz forums, their federation, how they treat musicians. The whole thing is like way ahead, even though they might think, well, we've still got problems. Anyway, in Scotland, you know, we're still in disarray. There's a Scottish psyche which is a little bit, as you'll know, quite destructive, because Scottish people don't like to say good things about Scottish people. You don't, you know, because, you know, when you grew up, your dad would say, you know, you didn't want to say that. You didn't want a big heat. If you, I'm going to hit you in the heat if you talk like that. If you start getting egotistical, you're going to get a slap. I mean, Scotland's just, you know, they're a child. It's really in its early stages of getting somewhere. But somebody has to begin the process. And it just happened to be me with the orchestra. It could have been anybody. Anybody could have put that together. It's just sacrifice a few years of their life and, you know, do the administration for 13 years and not get really paid for it. You know, that just takes somebody to sacrifice a bit of their own focus. And I mean, the same with the school. There was no school here. Norway's got 6 institutions that churn out musicians every year. We had none. And at the moment we have 1, and we've got the same population. How can we not have, we can have more. There's more potential in this country. We could have 1 in Aberdeen. We could have 1 in Edinburgh. Sure. I mean, the musicians who need a job, get your brain on, and, you know, there's a lot of potential here. But, you know, the school was hard. That was the hardest thing to start, because no university in Scotland wanted to do it. They were not interested in jazz. And each one of them had the power to start a jazz course, because it's up to them. They get the places from the government and they can dedicate it to whatever cause they want, whether it's folk music or harp course or, you know, anything. It's up to them. The mentality of their boards was anti-jazz. It was prejudice. And I know that for a fact, because I went to every university and pleaded my case. I went to the Scottish Higher Education Funding Council. I went to politicians. I went to the Minister of Culture. I tried to get support from everyone. And none of these people in the higher positions could dictate to the universities, you have to start a jazz course. But even though they might be on your side, they can't make that decision. The decision has to come from within a university. And none of them wanted to have it, because they're prejudice against the music. And you think, why are they prejudiced against this music? And you think about the history of the music and who are the famous people and what it's related to. And you think, well, I can understand now, because they've got issues with that. They've got issues with racism and drugs and alcohol and late night and this music is free. And they've got a lot of issues with that. So it took it took about 11 years since I started to convince a university level institution to say, oh, you know what? I think we should embrace that. You know, it's time. Yeah. It's time because we've had people who were here who've now left, who were in that prejudiced state of mind. And I believe that's one reason that in 2009, I got that call from the Royal Conservatory of Scotland. And it was basically these words, we're ready now. I mean, we're ready now. SNGO are doing some amazing things coming up. We've got this amazing project that we're working with our guts out at the moment for the middle of May, which we're recording at the end of April. And it's with a visual artist who's going to paint live onto an enormous stained glass window in the center of Edinburgh, just to make these virtual recordings a bit more interesting to watch. I mean, it's, I'll tell you, it's really boring to watch musicians read music. I mean, it just doesn't do it for me. You know, it might sound good, but looking at the image is like,
yeah.
You know, unless you're, you know, Albert Ayler going like crazy and you're, you know, spit flying everywhere, the horns flying all over the microphone, you know, and it's visually, wow, look at all this energy. Most people who sit in front of a music stand in a big band, it's not going to look that interesting. It's going to be very polite. You know, the microphone is here. You don't want to move too far because, you know, the sound is going to get carried away. So we need other elements. We need ballet. We need artists. We need people. We need videographers who are really crazy with their angles. You make it much more interesting to look at, you know. But the sound quality still has to be high. Just because it's a pre-record doesn't mean you have to, you know, record it as if it's like on your phone. You've still got to record it with great preamps, great microphones, and mix it and master it and get the reverb right, and or else what's the point? I mean, these things can last for a long time if they're put up on the net. You don't want to.
So in the calendar, you did promise me that maybe would be a revisit of Beasts of Scotland, which has great possibilities to bring in all kinds of art forms with it as well, I guess. I'd always love that. And you said, well, you might be revisiting that. Is that still something on the cards?
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember that conversation. Yeah, I think we called it, I was talking about Beasties.
Of Scotland.
Yeah. So the Beasts of Scotland, that was 96, Edward Morgan, Beasts. This is Beasties, which is focused on mythological, you know, like the unicorn, like the red cap, like the mermaids that, you know, that are there in Scotland. We've got the Loch Ness Monster. You're welcome to come up and see it after lockdown, still under the waves. You know, all these mythological creatures. We are going to do that. But that's
the Mars bar. I mean, that can't be real, can it? I mean, but yeah. that sounds like a lovely project. And is that something you're already writing?
No, the Beasties of Scotland, or the Book of Beasties, or we haven't got a title yet. That's going to be with four poets.
Mm-hmm.
we're working on this project at the moment that's called Where Rivers Meet, and that's focusing on Maria Rudd, this Russian artist who lives in Edinburgh, who's going to paint live. She's going to paint in 22-minute blocks this metamorphosis of work, and each of the four works, 22 minutes long, will be in conjunction with our soloist and the music that we're focusing on. So we've got Albert Ayler, we've got Ornette Coleman and Julie Redman and Anthony Braxton. So these are the expressionists of the saxophone, musicians who can express the simplest melody in the most emotional way. And so we've got four Scottish soloists, because we're not permitted to bring in international soloists, but doesn't matter. We've got soloists here who are equally as good to portray these characters. And so Maria Rudd will take Ayler, and the arrangement of that 22-minute suite, the Ayler suite, is done by Jeffrey Kieser in America. Mm-hmm. And he's taken a year to figure out how to get this working. And so we're doing it in St. Giles Cathedral, which is in the center of Edinburgh. It's about 12 steps from the heart of Midlothian, the heart of the city. It's a 12th century city. And in this cathedral, there's a big west stained glass window. It's absolutely ginormous. It's gigantic. And we are all in this kind of place around the bottom of this window. Her artwork's being projected on the window. And so the editing will be really important. We've got three videographers and two lock cams, and we're going to really make this a really visual concert. So with the expressionism in the music and the soloists portraying these avant-garde musicians, we have this art and the place and the people. It's going to be a phenomenal experience, and it's called Where Rivers Meet, and that's where my focus is at the moment. It's going to be really great, and we're going to do four different premieres of these concerts to give people time to reflect on them, and there'll be interviews from the soloists and the artist, and we'll put it together really professionally with great audio, and so that's what we're working on just now. And once that's through, I'll get my head into something else, but that's what's going through here every day
moment
for the last couple of weeks now. So,
Tommy, it's been an absolute great pleasure talking to you. We must let you get on as well. And thank you so much for giving us your time. And I have to say, to try and get out of lockdown, it would be lovely to meet you over a pint of heavy, maybe. And perhaps in Edinburgh, because it's always been such a great cultural centre, with the Edinburgh Festival being probably the top arts festival in the world, and the Edinburgh Jazz Festival, which sort of sits in the earlier part, really, of coming into that. With every good wish that we might get out by then, we look forward to the future projects. And Tommy Smith, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Chris. My pleasure. Howard, Chris, many thanks.
Great
to see you. Hopefully see you too as well.